Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. On today's show, we'll be talking with Chef Ashley Christensen, who has seven restaurants in Raleigh, North Carolina, and a brand new cookbook. And we'll also be talking to Lori Wollever. She's here to talk about her latest project, Appetites, a cookbook she wrote with Anthony Bourdain. Perhaps you've heard of him. This season of Radio Cherry Bomb is brought to you by Knopf, publisher of food's most fabulous icons, from Julia Child to Lydia Bastianich, and home to new literary talents such as Sweet Bitters' Stephanie Dandler. Speaking of Stephanie, we are doing an event with her in Chicago on Tuesday, October 18th at 6 p.m. at the Boarding House. If you live in Chicago, if you have friends in Chicago, spread the word. Tickets are available through Eventbrite. They're $75. They include a signed copy of the book, a copy of Cherry Bomb, great wine, hors d'oeuvres, and some sweet treats to take home from Vosges Haute Chocolat and Wild Ophelia. You can go to our Instagram page for the ticket link. Did you read that book yet, Ashley?
I have not read it
I'm
yet.
I'm jumping ahead. I haven't properly introduced Ashley yet. It's a really good book because it's beautifully written. Stephanie is like an amazing young literary talent, but it's set in a restaurant. She's like a back server, and it's a fictionalized account of Union Square Cafe.
Yes. I just heard about it. I look forward to reading it.
And as a restaurant owner, it might give you heart palpitations to read the book. Here, you know, reading and seeing what goes on with the staff behind the scenes.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It might not be the most relaxing read for you. It might be more like nonfiction.
I'll save that for after the holidays.
Absolutely. But again, if you're in Chicago, we would love to hang out with you. So
awesome.
Check out those tickets. Chef Ashley Christensen. She is widely considered the queen of Raleigh, North Carolina, where she has seven fantastic restaurants, including her newest, Death and Taxes. Is that still your newest? I feel like I've lost track.
That's still the newest.
Death and Taxes. Ashley recently published her first cookbook, Pools, Recipes and Stories from a Modern Diner. It's a celebration of the very first restaurant she opened. Ashley's a good friend, and I'm thrilled to welcome her to Radio Cherry Bomb for the first time.
So awesome to be here. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on the cookbook.
Thank you so much.
Huge undertaking. I was shocked that it's your first cookbook. I just assumed that you had, I don't know, a dozen cookbooks already under your belt.
Well, it's something I've wanted to do my entire cooking career. And really, we're about to celebrate our ninth year at our first restaurant, Pools Diner. And I finally felt ready. And, you know, you make the negotiations and figure out who you're going to work with. And I'm working with, or did work and continue to work with 10 Speed Press. My editor is Jenny Wapner. And it was just a tremendous experience, really amazing, super positive. And I can actually say it was so much harder than I thought it would be, which I think is the case for most folks on their first book. But it was such an incredible experience. I'm excited to do it again.
We can attest to that. We're shooting the Cherry Bomb cookbook. Right now, we shot your recipe yesterday, these awesome grilled oysters. Working on a cookbook is a bitch.
Yeah,
nobody
really
tells
is.
You. I mean, it's fascinating and fun, but it's... Man, it's tough. Nobody tells you.
It's true. I've got a 2-book deal with 10 Speed Press, and working through first just what the first concept would be, and deciding, you know, do you write the sort of big life book of all the things that you want to share? Or, you know, then I looked at Pools, which was really the restaurant that introduced us to not just everyone in the country, but also to ourselves, you know, where I think we really got to know who we wanted to be in cooking and the stories we wanted to share, and just really, I think, believing in the story of who we are. So it felt really natural to make that the first book.
When I was doing my tiny bit of homework that I did for today's episode, I read that you opened Pools in 2007, and it shocked me because I guess I feel like I've known you for as long as I've been in the restaurant world, and Pools is such a bright spot on the national restaurant scene. I couldn't believe it's as young as it is.
I think it's one of those places, and one of the things that really I connected to immediately was the history of the space and the fact that it is this old diner in Raleigh that would have been, had it been operated by the same folks who built it, would now be the third oldest restaurant in downtown Raleigh. So it was really special to us to share that history and to continue that story. But I think that feeling that you get is because of it being such a, you know, we're 9 years there, which can feel like a lifetime in the restaurant business, and we're very proud to still be there. But well beyond our time there, that place has such an old soul.
Tell us about the food at Pools and why everybody needs to put it on their bucket list.
Sure. It's, I think for me, when I walked in that restaurant with the idea of it was for sale and I felt very much ready to do my first project, I walked in and I had no idea what I was going to cook, but I had this immediate feeling that I think Diner really delivers of comfort. And I think that's what we get and that we strive for and that we're attracted to in the American diner. So for us, you know, in a really interesting place, Raleigh, North Carolina, interesting on a lot of levels right now, but agriculturally just fantastic. And, you know, to be in a place where you get to cook for folks in this, with this, you know, focus of comfort, but in such a fun kind of exciting environment, as the city has just really been growing and growing for the 10 years that we've been working on this project. We felt when I purchased the lease, it was intended to be a turnkey. And of course, with that typical surprise that most new restaurant owners get, it took us about a year to open it. So it has been, we're coming up on our ninth year, but it's been a 10-year project. But the restaurant itself has just been such an awesome way to celebrate all the things that are growing and happening in our beautiful state of North Carolina, and to like dial in on this idea of comfort, but to let it truly be something that's evolving.
But the food is most definitely not diner food.
Right.
Tell us some of the highlights from the menu.
Yeah, I think the way that we connect with the diner idea is by finding different ways to express comfort, but not necessarily being totally traditional to the foods of the American diner, but really dialing in on that, still that same feeling. So, you know, the menu is broken down in appetizers, vinaigrette dishes, mains, and next two items. And what I think that allows us to do is for people to come in and create all kinds of experiences, but that they're all really shareable, and that it encourages you to get a number of different dishes and to share plates and pass plates around. Things that are always on the menu, most of them are in the book, the macaroni au gratin,
yum,
which I think is just a great example of a simple dish done well. And for that, it's made a real impression well beyond the state of North Carolina, which is exciting.
I've had that, and mac and cheese is like my favorite food in the world. And yours is definitely top five.
That's great to hear. And you know, everyone, I feel like our version is a very purist version, very straightforward, but just really focusing on the details. So, you know, I think in the vinaigrette dishes, it's a place where we celebrate the season and like in just celebrating single note items. So thinking of a vinaigrette that's going to pair with whatever the most striking piece of the dish is. So, right, you know, the thing that's always on the menu is just a simple bib lettuce salad with a really beautiful red wine vinaigrette, which I think is a really great launching pad for the rest of that section. And then, you know, as we move into fall, we'll get our first kind of early pumpkins, and we'll do some, you know, pickled pumpkin salads that might have a little bit of beautiful country ham or prosciutto, something like a locally made creamy style cheese, maybe like a goat's milk cheese, and then just a bright vinaigrette with the pickled pumpkin to kind of tie everything together.
I'm officially starving now. What about desserts? What's the must-have on the dessert menu?
Well, right now it's, you know, we just had a really beautiful review in the New York Times, and they called out a handful of dishes that they cooked. But the one that they were most stunned by is the sweet potato hummingbird cake, which is an old cake, which I think another great example of sort of our mission is to take old classics. So this was a recipe that came, I believe, out of a 1970s Southern Living magazine recipe. And we have this beautiful collaboration with our executive pastry chef for the whole company. And he has such a fun time, like going back and researching old recipes and then looking, you know, North Carolina. I once cooked a Southern dinner in London, and the sweet sweet potatoes that they brought in were from North Carolina. So it's like such a specific offering for, they're everywhere, but we have so many amazing sweet potatoes. That's something we work through the cold season to find really exciting ways to express on the menu. In the book, we've got back to the vinaigrette idea. We've got a roasted sweet potato dish that has, you know, roasted poblanos and chev and then just like a really beautiful vinaigrette that brings the whole thing together.
Yum. So let's go back to 10 years ago when you took over that lease and you mm-hmm. were just a baby. What was your vision for your career? Did you know you'd have this empire one day?
No, it was my vision for my career was that space. You know, it really felt, I was satisfied by it in so many ways and it felt like such a great challenge. And this old, you know, this old diner, it's a 2000 square foot shotgun diner, double horseshoe bar in the front. And it's kind of like, you know, it's a cook's dream. It's sort of the perfect size restaurant. We max out at 70 seats if we seat all of the counter, which we do every night. And, you know, it's an opportunity to really be at the center of your community and to do something that is welcome to, you know, to evolve and to change. So it felt like a place that I could be happy for my entire life. That said, of course, 3 years later, we went on to do some new things. And I don't think it was like my desire to figure out how to be challenged and satisfied. More than anything, I looked around and at all these amazing folks that work with us. And I knew that it would be impossible to continue to promote them in the ways that they deserve to be promoted in this small space. And I also so enjoyed meeting new people and working with them and working through the different stages and levels of the restaurant. So our growth was really based on the awesomeness of all of our folks who we worked with and deciding that we wanted to find new ways to keep them involved and moving on and forward. And also, you know, looking around a city that changed, you know, and that changed us in great ways and that we wanted to continue to feel connected with in the way that this diner had made us feel as such a special part of the place we call home.
How have you evolved as a leader?
In a lot of ways. So I think that as I look back at the way that I had the pleasure of teaching folks by working right next to them and side by side every day in the early years of Poole's Diner. That was an amazing experience, but it didn't ask enough of me as a leader who needed to grow more and to learn how to really give people more than the experience of just working in that place. So I think as we opened up more restaurants and created new experiences, not just for the folks that we were working with and the people that we would be feeding and making drinks for and entertaining, it was a whole new experience for me to learn to be the most that I could be and the best that I could be to all the folks that we were working with. So those circumstances and the change in everyday life really brought me to a whole new place, I think, as a leader. And I definitely view it differently than I did when we opened up that first tiny place. And now I look at everything and I used to figure out how to give the folks around us everything that I could, but also I was figuring out how to stay ahead of where we wanted them to be, because that seemed really natural based on the experiences that I'd had. But now I look back and the things that I'm most proud of and that I feel like are our greatest achievements are the folks who have gone beyond what we could give them, who still work with us, but are, you know, sort of masters of their own specific areas of what we do. And they have excelled far beyond what I had the experience to give them. And I'm super proud of that.
So how did you educate yourself though? Like, did you read every business book out there? Did you go to those Zingerman classes? Like what, how do you become a better leader?
Sure. I think for me, it had a lot to do with maturity. And I think when I look back and think about the things, how I used to feel really insecure about the things that I didn't know, once I realized like what an amazing feeling it was to learn together with all these incredible folks whose strengths and personalities were very different than my own, and what we could collectively do when I was mature enough to really be very comfortable with all the strengths of the folks who surrounded me, and I think it takes someone in the leadership position to really be comfortable with embracing strengths that the people around you have that you don't have. And for that, you know, once I got to that place, I think we became so much stronger and capable of so much more. And that now, where I used to get so much satisfaction by teaching myself and figuring out how to share that, now I get the same satisfaction from learning from the folks that we have the pleasure of working with. So,
do you have any mentors?
I think of every day, I feel like I have a mentor, you know, and my parents, of course, like most, are huge mentors for me and their approach to food and their commitment to the importance of us as a family sharing in food every day, and food not just being about putting food in your bellies. It was about the experience of sitting down and having conversations and sharing, you know, experiences of the day. I think I consider them tremendous mentors for that. Our mutual friend, Andrea Rusing, who has Lantern in the Durham Hotel, I had the pleasure of working for her for only about 10 months at a restaurant that I ended up becoming the chef of after she left. But I think of, she changed the way I thought about sourcing and the way that I understood what was growing around me and how to connect with vendors who I think at the time, vendors and growers who at the time, it was a little more challenging to communicate with and figure out how to work together because both parties had very different strengths and very different focus and goals. So I definitely think of Andrea. Scott Howell of Nana's in Durham was someone who I worked with again for 10 months because I had worked for Andrea, left when she left, went to work for him, and then was offered the opportunity to come back as the executive chef of that restaurant. But he was someone who had very traditional and what's the word? He had the experience of having attended, you know, a culinary school. He attended CIA and worked all over the world and found such joy in sharing his experiences with folks who were committed to work with him.
Mentors always struck me as a really funny word because I don't think you necessarily know who your mentors are in the moment.
In the moment, sure.
And it's not until you kind of look back. And it's not like you go up to somebody and say, can you be my mentor?
Sure.
You know?
Well, I look at it and I think about like the Southern Foodways Alliance, who I feel like taught me so much about finding my own voice in cooking and recognizing the parts of my story and my past that would truly be a part of that moving forward. And they also taught me how to really celebrate the friendships in cooking that I would make and recognize. And I think that's been such a tremendous part. That has been such a tremendous part of how I approach my education now. So much of it is based on sharing kitchens while cooking for great causes all over the country with amazing chefs and restaurateurs. And so when I think about my version of the modern mentor, I think it's everyone who opens themselves up to those experiences.
You know, speaking of traveling around and working in kitchens, you do a lot of that on behalf of charities. I know my restaurant took part in a No Kid Hungry event at Pools, and you give a lot of time to a lot of organizations. What's your approach? Restaurants get hit. I mean, for listeners who don't know this, restaurants get hit up all the time to participate in every single charity and fundraiser and whatnot. Yeah. How have you decided what to focus on and what organizations are important to you?
It's very interesting. I was reading my email on the way here today, and you know, that's one of the other things about writing a cookbook. There were probably, you know, 17 requests in my inbox for autographed cookbooks now. and every
people
day,
want your autograph now,
sure.
Ashley.
Everyone in restaurants is so used to being constantly asked to be a part of great causes. And I'm sure that we would all love to do it all. But what I've really dialed into is figuring out what I can have the most impact, where I can have the most impact. So you mentioned Share Our Strength, and that's, you know, the diner. We might seat 70 people for an annual dinner that we do. And we just celebrated our sixth dinner with No Kid Hungry and Share Our Strength. And we've raised thus far $650,000.
It's amazing. The dinner that we participated in, that auction.
Yeah.
I mean, people were just dropping money like crazy. And I was like, Ashley really is major in this town to be able to pull this off. It was impressive. Well, you raised a lot of money for that group.
It's an incredible community and a truly generous community. And I think the real key as a leader and as a, you know, as a chef or the, you know, the person who runs a restaurant is realizing what a tremendous opportunity it is to engage with your community. And so, for example, that dinner and really any dinner that we do in the restaurant, my approach is to, when I greet the room, to say, you know, we're so happy to have you here. Here's the cause we're working and fighting for tonight. And for everyone who's here, and you know, you bought a ticket to be here. We brought in these amazing chefs to be a part of tonight, but I want to be very clear that your presence here is not just, you didn't buy just dinner and glasses of wine. You bought the opportunity to give at a greater level. And I think that, you know, much like restaurants are asked for to be a part of so many things, I think everyone's asked to do that and to see the opportunities to give. And I think people really want to give. They just want to feel like they're giving to the right things. So I think as restaurant leaders and chefs who our communities really view as being at the center of the community, it's a tremendous responsibility. So it's about putting energy into steering that ship.
Or steering whatever.
Yeah, it's about really taking that influence and using it properly. Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of that, and since you've become such a big part of the Raleigh business community, we have to talk about that stupid bathroom bill. So for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, it's HB2, officially the Public Facilities Privacy and Security Act. And it says that you can only use the bathroom that's on your birth certificate. And obviously, this did not sit well with a lot of people, not just in North Carolina, but around the country.
Sure.
And there have been boycotts of North Carolina, some very major ones, and it has to be hurting a lot of the businesses there. So what's your position on this whole thing?
It's hurting everyone in North Carolina right now. And I think I'm definitely opposed to the bill. We're working very hard to make sure that folks in our state know that the best way to change this is to vote and to, you know, to really speak up and stand up for causes that you believe in. We've always been very careful as a restaurant. For myself personally, I try never to hang my own political agenda over the doorstep of our restaurants, because I'm a big believer in the idea that if you want to create change, the first thing you have to do is to get people to the table to discuss it. And so I feel like we want to bring folks into the restaurant, and we want to conduct ourselves in a way that makes it very clear that we these are our beliefs and these are the things we support. So when it came to issues of equality and just basic human rights, I felt very strongly that it was our opportunity to not blast everything that was going on in North Carolina, but to say, Here's where we stand. Here's how we feel about it. As you know, we took that opportunity to take our single occupancy restrooms and to make them, instead of, you know, men's rooms and women's rooms, we made them people rooms. And it's absolutely the right thing to do. There's no one who would experience any level of discomfort or threat because of that. But we naturally then began to receive all these letters in the mail.
Are you kidding? And
emails. But what was really incredibly clear about those letters was that the majority of those people had never set foot in our restaurant. It was something that they, you know, they'd sort of trolled online or seen, you know, publicized somewhere. So pretty interesting. But again, I think for when it comes to these issues that are happening in our state right now, and this bill in particular, it's about educating people about how they can make positive change and conducting ourselves with great positivity.
And I guess it's kind of funny because you have an awesome ladies' room in Pools that I guess is now a people's room. But I'm trying to remember what was so distinctive. You have like bobby pins and
we've got all the things,
feminine hygiene products
We asked ourselves when you find yourself in a restaurant and you have that sort of oh no moment where there's something you need that. So we just tried to make sure all those things were provided. And I love that idea of hospitality being about considering all the different stages and levels of comfort that make people really feel at home. That said, in the early days, someone, you know, it came up from this, our, the staff, the male members of our staff, like, why don't we have that stuff in our bathroom? And we went back and forth about it. And I said, okay, fine, let's do it. And we put in a shelf and we went back and forth about the items that should be on that shelf. Finally, we, you know, did this installation. It was there.
What's their equivalent of a tampon? I'm trying to wrap my head around that.
Do you really want me to get into it?
No, don't. Maybe. Okay. Skip that.
So anyway, on a busy Friday night, a guy sort of like stumbles out of the bathroom with a shelf under his arm, who had clearly had a little too much to drink. And I happened to be standing there as he walked up, and he just handed the shelf over and said, I don't know what it was doing in there anyway. But now that their people rooms were accept, we're actually doing a little renovation on our bathroom in the next couple weeks on the what was previously the men's room to help it to be equal to the previous women's room.
I look forward to checking them both out next time I'm at pools. One last question before we get up to the speed round.
Sure.
You are one of the few women in the restaurant world to have an empire. Why do so few women in the business have multiple restaurant empires? I really can only think of a handful.
That's a tough...
Suzanne Goen, right, out in L.A. You've got Martha Hoover in Indianapolis. You've got April Bloomfield here, of course.
Sure.
A few other women I'm sure I'm forgetting. But why so few?
That's a really tough question. I guess I have to wonder if it is a little more equal when we look at the number of chefs who own and operate, if it'd be a little more in balance with men and women. But I don't really know the answer to that. It's a great question, and I think it's something that is probably changing. And I feel like I hear a lot these days about women opening multiple concepts, and it's completely reasonable to me that would be the case, that we would all be, you know, that men and women would have the same shot currently at operating. And I would imagine, based on the challenges of being a woman in the business previously, that I really feel are improving, and because people are talking about it more, and I hope that changes across the board.
I think it will. I mean, you are starting to see a lot more. Like, the first ones who come to mind are the Sabrina and Alyssa, who have Dimes on the Lower East Side. Like, they now have three locations. They they moved their restaurant to a bigger space. They have Dimes Deli, and then they have a little grocery store, which is fantastic. So
awesome.
I have a feeling we're going to start to see a lot more of things like that.
Yes, absolutely.
I hope so. Okay, Ashley, time for the speed round.
I'm excited. So,
emphasis on speed.
Okay.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
How do you take it?
Touch of milk.
Sweet or salty?
Ooh, both. Salty if I have to choose.
What's in your fridge right now?
Lots of pickles from way too many gifts of pickles.
What kitchen tool do you use the most?
Tasting spoon.
If you were trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be?
Oh, wow.
Who's the first one that comes
Alton
to mind?
Alton Brown.
Alton Brown, okay.
Because he's so resourceful, I feel like we would actually survive.
Good answer. What are you reading right now, aside from your own cookbook?
I just got Vivian Howard's cookbook. It's beautiful, and I can't wait to read it cover to cover.
It's a beauty. Where would you like to travel to next, and why?
I am traveling to Paris next.
Ooh.
To celebrate Kate Golan's birthday here in, this just happened in September. And we happen to have the opportunity to see Bon Iver while we're there. So we're going to eat a lot of great food. We'll be with friends and see some great music.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Well, Ashley, thank you for stopping by. It's been really fun talking to you. Don't forget to pick up a copy of Ashley's cookbook, Pools, Recipes and Stories from a Modern Diner. We'll be right back after this word from Knopf. Imagine the culinary world without the influence of Julia Child, Marcello Hazan, Edna Lewis, Maher Joffrey, Lydia Bastianich, and Judith Jones, it's impossible. We have the iconic publishing house Knopf to thank for bringing the writings and the recipes of these women to life. Knopf's great tradition of supporting new voices continues today with Smitten Kitchen's Deb Perlman, Sweet Bitter's Stephanie Danler, and Butter Baked Good's Rosie Dakin. Check out Knopf's great collection of fiction, nonfiction, and cookbooks at your favorite bookstore. Keep reading and keep cooking with Knopf. Our next guest is the writer Lori Wool-Ever. She has hustled her butt off to make it as a writer in New York City, working as an assistant to Mario Batali, as a private chef, and as an editor at multiple publications. As she wrote on the website thebillfold.com, "I still have no idea how anyone supports themselves as a writer in New York, but Lori is proof that you can make it," and she's here today to tell us how. Lori, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're super excited to have you on the show. So I've known about you for a while, so it's nice to meet you in person. I've seen your byline here and there. And you are the gatekeeper to Anthony Bourdain.
Gatekeeper, yes. That was his term, and I took it and ran with it.
So what exactly does it mean to be a gatekeeper? I have a vision of, like, you know, a literal gate and someone like hanging off the gate in a uniform.
Well, I think primarily it means fielding all the many questions and queries and requests and all the kinds of things that people want from him, mostly his time and interviews and all that kind of stuff. Anybody who wants to schedule something with him or get some information to him generally comes to me. And then it's all whatever else comes up in the course of a day or the course of a week. I do lots of different jobs just depending on what the needs are at the time.
So I would imagine you need two distinct skills: organization, mm-hmm. and the ability to say no.
Yes, nicely and very, very polite no.
What are your secrets for those of us who have a hard time saying no?
Well, you know, email really helps because you don't have to look at somebody when you're saying no. And, just being kind I've got a couple of phrases that I don't want to like give all my secrets away, but, a couple of phrases that are kind and succinct and just sort of let you know that I respect you. However, it's, you know, your request is going to be denied.
And how about the organization part?
You know, it's funny. I don't think of myself as a particularly organized person, but I know I can be. I just find it in my own life. I find it sort of boring and tiresome. But I know that I'm able to do it when it's a job and it's somebody else's, details of their life. And I think things like the iPhone make it possible for disorganized people to be organized. When I worked for Mario, we did not have any of this. You know, we didn't even have the internet. I mean, it existed, but it wasn't in our work world. And I was sometimes a complete disaster. You know, I worked off a legal pad and had a little phone and a pencil, and I was constantly losing things and, you know, freaking out. So it's better. The technology makes it a lot easier now.
And you're a mom.
And
did you
mom.
Get more organized after you had your son?
I think so. Yeah. Again, I still feel like, am I that organized? I don't know. Like yesterday we ran out of pretzels. We didn't have any snacks for the lunch bag. But it does force you to at least go home most nights, wake up the same time every morning, and just sort of it organizes your life for you in a way. So it makes it easier to kind of fall into line.
I feel like the pretzel thing is something he'll remember in like 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the weird little things you remember about your parents.
Yeah, the ways in which they fail.
Remember when mom forgot the pretzels?
Yeah.
You know, and like that's such a big thing, mm-hmm. you know, in the moment. But
totally.
Yeah. So you're here today to talk about this very cool project, Appetites, a cookbook that
yes.
you worked on with Anthony. Mm-hmm. Do you call him Tony?
Call him Tony.
Tony,
yeah.
That you worked on with Tony. And what a cool project.
It is. I'm really proud of it. I was so excited and kind of blown away to get the offer to do it. It took me, you know, no time at all to say yes, of course, and just jump right in. I'm really, really proud of it. I just got the first copy a week ago, and it felt like somebody was handing me my baby. You know, it was really...
Your second baby.
Yeah. It's so, you know, so much work goes into it. From me, from Tony, from a million people who never really get the recognition. It's such a massive project to make a book of any kind at all. So I'm really excited about it. And I think it's really cool and really visually different from a lot of the cookbooks that are out there. Somebody described it as grotesque, which we took as a compliment.
Who was the food stylist?
Victoria Granoff.
Oh, we love Victoria.
A genius. And just so funny and just had such great ideas. She brought in just so many things we had never even considered and was also willing to go with the kind of out there stuff that we did bring to the table. So it was great to work with her.
She was our food stylist for our Christina Tosi cover. Oh. And she actually had her assistant hot glue Fruit Loops to make a Fruit Loop quilt this Persian cat that somebody was bringing to set. And needless to say, the Persian cat took one look at the Fruit Loops quilt and absolutely refused to go anywhere near it. We could have put like tons of catfish, tons of like cat food under that quilt, and that cat wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. But Victoria is a mad genius.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, she's fantastic. It's a very personal cookbook, which I thought was nice. Mm-hmm. Tony talks a lot about his family and their recipes. Well, you tell us. They seem like they're recipes that are super authentic and meaningful to him.
Yeah, they kind of run the gamut from recipes that he loves to cook for his daughter, things that he likes to do, entertaining, and then some that are things that he had on the road all over the world. I mean, there are not so many of those. It's not like Tony Bourdain's travels, but there are three or four that really resonated with him and that are easy enough to replicate at home. They do tend to be the ones with a more intensive shopping requirement, but so it's really, it is a, and then there are also, recipes from his time as a cook and a chef. A couple of childhood things. There are a few that are straight from my head that I'm very proud of.
Such as
there's a salad, a dochois salad. Pickled Vietnamese style vegetables with sprouts and hard boiled egg, and that's I made that one up. There's another salad that's Boston lettuce with julienne radishes and apples and a yogurt dressing that I like to make for when I get together with my neighbors who have kids. And then there's a pasta that a friend taught me 20 years ago that she had learned in Italy that's just very simple spaghetti with melted anchovies and garlic and parsley.
Yum.
So those are mine. I don't know if I'm really supposed to say that, but it's true.
So this is not your first time at the Bourdain Cookbook Rodeo.
Correct.
You two, tell us about your first cookbook experience.
So back in 2002, I started working on the, it's called Anthony Bourdain's Layal Cookbook. And that was a smaller role, but I had just come from working for Mario and doing cookbooks with him. And Tony reached out to Mario and asked him if he knew anybody that could help kind of get the recipes from kitchen Bible format into, home use format. So I worked with Tony and I worked really closely with his chef at the time, Jose, going through the kitchen Bible and turning those Layal recipes into, home cook style recipe. I mean, we didn't really change the recipe significantly, just made them, sort of standardized and scaled down. So that was my first time working with Tony. I didn't see him very often. I still don't see him very often. I mean, it's this wonderful working relationship where we like and respect one another, but because he travels so often, most of what we do, our work is via email. So it kind of takes the pressure off of having to see somebody every single day. And then when we do see each other, I'm always very happy to see him. But for me, it works. I like a lot of solitude, so that works out well. So that was how we did the first book as well, was everything was just back and forth via email with a couple of in-person meetings. And then the book came out, and that was 2004. So it's been quite a while. And then it was 5 years later that I started working as his assistant.
So you two are very different people now than you were back then. And you probably have like a little bit of a different working rhythm. Mm-hmm. How were the two experiences different in terms of the cookbooks?
I tested all the recipes for the Layal book, which is unusual and, probably not the best form for people to both write and test the recipes.
Yeah, I read you tested them and edited them and you got paid $50 per recipe plus groceries.
Yes. So that, you know, we had them tested outside this time, which is, you know, I think 12 years ago, the budgets were certainly smaller and the time frame was tighter and there was just, it was a different scale. It was a different publisher. You know, everything was different in that way. And my role was much more limited in terms of any of writing. You know, all of those head notes, all of the, everything in there is Tony. And he also went in and added a lot of editorializing within the recipes themselves. This book, the recipes are more straight, less, but you're still getting some editorializing and some little, there's actually a lot of helpful sort of, this is how you're going to screw it up, you know, or this is what most people do. Don't do that. You know, there's definitely an element of that still in there. And I had more of a hand in working on the head notes and doing some of the editing for the long essays. So I feel more ownership of this book, and I feel like it was far more collaborative.
And you have a credit on the cover, which is fab.
And I have a credit on the cover, which is everything.
And the cover's fantastic. You got Ralph Steadman, who did all the artwork for Hunter S. Thompson, mm-hmm. to do the artwork for this, and it's just kind of brilliant.
I think so. It's, and I can't take any credit for wrangling Ralph Steadman, but I'm very happy that he agreed to do it. You know, the cover is very, it's aggressive. There are some retailers that have asked for a, like a modesty cover because it's,
for real?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, they think that, and also initially the book was just called Appetites and we were pressured to change it to Appetites, a cookbook, because people thought they might not know what it is just looking at the cover. So you gotta play ball a little bit with the rest of the country. So yeah, some retailers and some markets will have like a plain white wrapper sort of thing, which is subversive in its own way.
The collector's edition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you find time for your own writing?
It's not easy. I just kind of have to force myself. I try and do my own writing first thing in the day, and that sometimes works, and sometimes there's just urgent business that I just have to get to. But you know, deadlines help. Knowing that I'm being paid helps, and you know, just kind of figuring out a way to put in a couple hours a day. I will say it's a relief to not only be a writer, because I think if I had nothing to do but write for 8 or 12 hours a day, I think I would really lose it. I get very squirrely, you know, after a couple of hours. So it's, and my job with Tony is starting to feel more and more like a full-time job, but initially it wasn't. So you know, the idea was that there was this built-in time for me to write. So, yeah, it's really, I mean, it's, I don't have a good sort of strategy. It's just like, get an assignment, freak out, procrastinate, and then start writing and you know, make your deadline. So
the freak out is always essential.
It's a totally essential part of the process.
Are you a procrastinator?
I am. Yeah, I am.
That's hard.
Big time. Yeah. I think this is not an unusual thing, but for me, there is some motivating energy around, you know, being like, okay, well now I have 2 days and I have to do this, you know, and there's no more time to waste, basically.
Do you have any dream assignments? We should put them out into the universe and see if we can make them happen for you.
You know, I always love a travel-based assignment. And those are, they're starting to happen a little bit more now. I'm starting to understand how to pitch those a little bit more and how to, and sometimes they end up having to be self-financed, which is not ideal, but I found recently that if I was willing to go buy a cheap ticket, fly to the destination, you know, my fee for writing the story just about covered my travel expenses, and it was worth it. I got the story, you know, the editor was thrilled and wants me back in the magazine. So, you know, it's always great when somebody else is paying, but if you can afford to self-finance once and show them that you're serious, I think sometimes it is worth it, and it's a write-off. So,
and if you're a scrappy enough person, you can find ways to sort of maximize that trip.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And do a lot of different stories. But that's kind of getting harder and harder. You and I touched on that a little bit outside, mm-hmm. that I think back in the day, you know, when we were younger people, mm-hmm. you could really hustle and have multiple jobs and afford to live in the city and have mm-hmm. an existence. I think it's a lot harder now. Everything's so expensive.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think it's probably also true that as we get older, we're less, you know, I think about the apartment I used to live in and, you know, that I was being comfortable with having $0 in my checking account, you know, things that didn't faze me that I think I would not be happy with now as a lady in her 40s. But it is true. I mean, the rent that I paid was so tiny compared to the rents now everywhere. I don't know how. I feel, you know, a lot of empathy for young people coming here out of college trying to figure out how to make it. So, but they still do.
Well, Lori, we are about to jump to the speed round.
Okay.
So, nothing too tricky.
Okay.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
How do you take it?
Milk.
Sweet. Ashley said the same exact thing. Sweet or salty?
Salty.
What is in your fridge right now?
Some leftover butternut squash roasted. There's some milk. There's some cashew almond milk blend. There's some grapes. Actually, a very full fridge. We have a tiny little fridge, so it always seems really packed.
Are you making your own nut milks?
No.
It didn't seem like an activity you would indulge in.
No, I don't, you know, I don't judge it. I think it's great, but I've never.
You don't have a nut milk bag?
No.
I remember when I bought that for the first time, I was so embarrassed when I took it to the register.
Yeah, it says...
It said in big letters, nut milk bag.
They could probably come up with a better name for that.
Somebody can make some money if they come up with a better name for that. What kitchen tool do you use the most?
The blender.
If you were trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be? You can't say your boss.
Oh, that sounds terrible. One food celebrity. God, that's a great question, and I probably should have prepared for this.
First person who comes
okay.
to mind.
Padma Lakshmi.
Why Padma?
Oh, I don't know. She was literally the first person that came to my mind, but I feel like she would be a good time and maybe likes to smoke weed. I don't know. That's
What are you reading?
The New York Times.
Where would you like to travel to next?
Japan. Back to Japan. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that is it for today's show. Lori, I feel like we could have talked to you for a whole hour, so you have to come back.
I will.
I know you've got a lot of promotional work to do. Say that word. Promotional work to do for this book. But maybe in the spring when you have some free time, you can come back and visit us.
I would love to.
It was a pleasure speaking with Ashley and Lori today. Thanks as always to our engineer, Dave Tatasciore, and much love to Knopf for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb and for publishing such beautiful books. Don't forget to support Heritage Radio, the not-for-profit home of Radio Cherry Bomb. To make a donation, visit heritageradionetwork.org. Again, if you're in Chicago, come check out our event with Stephanie Dandler at the Boarding House on October 18th. Ticket information is on our Instagram page, feed, whatever we call that. And thank you for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
I'm Alex Scheitzman, Marketing Manager at Natural Gourmet Institute and creator of thenewbaguette.com, a healthy food blog featuring practical recipes for busy people. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Sharon Bowers, the rock star literary agent responsible for bringing many of our favorite cookbooks to life.